Fast Money starts right now, live from the Nasdaq market site overlooking New York City's Times Square. I'm Melissa Lee. Your traders on the desk are Steve Grasso, Mark Tepper, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. Tonight on Fast, the man who moves markets is here. JP Morgan's Marco Kalanovic says the market lows are in, and you will not believe how high he thinks the stocks can go this year. Plus, the IPO freeze as Uber, Lyft, Pinterest, and Airbnb get ready to make their debut. Will the government shutdown derail this highly anticipated IPO stream? We will explain. We start off with the bank bonanza. Goldman Sachs surging 10%, Bank of America surging 8%, taking the whole sector higher after better than expected earnings. The KBW banking index is now up a whopping 11% so far this year. So, after being one of the worst performing sectors last year, is 2019 turning out to be the year of the banks, Guy?
I thought they were going to, they said my year, they were going to play the Al Stewart song, Year of the Cat, and then they didn't play it. It makes me look, I was so excited. No is the answer to your question, though, Melissa. And we have to welcome our guest.
Welcome, Mark.
Well, she
Pepper.
Did on the opening.
No, but this is a formal now.
Oh. Well, a formal one.
Well, thank you.
You know,
thank
kudos you. To Dan Nathan, by the way, who a couple weeks ago said, really? You know, the setup for a lot of these banks was probably positive. A lot of them troughed. Earnings weren't going to be great, maybe good enough, and maybe we'll see a rally. That's what we've seen. In terms of Goldman Sachs, to me, it was only one number that made a difference in Goldman, and that was tangible book went from 186 to about 197. And the move higher today is just the market recalibrating where that move was and where the stock is now. So can they continue to rally? Yes, but most of these banks, XLF, Goldman Sachs, are still in a pretty steep downtrend from the beginning of last year.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, just to be clear, my view, that was January 2nd, January 3rd, before the banks really started to get going. So as we got a week into the year, I did not like the strength heading into the earnings. I thought the setup wasn't great from a sentiment standpoint, even though they had literally gone down in a straight line 20, 25% across the board. I think what's really important to remember here is that this is a reflex move. If you look at all the charts, just draw a line, take a ruler, they're still in pretty significant downtrends. I'd also highlight the KRE, this is the regional banking index, also was down more sharply than the larger banks, and it's still in a big downtrend.
So it reeks,
I think
reeks
if you're buying
position.
Them here, you're doing it wrong. You know what I mean?
Right.
You had to buy them when it looked really ugly.
Goldman Sachs up 10%, 9% reeks of positioning to me. The XLE, you just talked about the banking index, XLE is up 8% year to date. This is all positioning. Sell the banks. These are low quality beats. There's nothing to be excited about.
Can I, though, hold on that point? Because I'm going to bring up a phrase that we always refer
like
to on
phrases.
The desk. Bad news, good price action.
Mm.
Isn't that what we saw during bank earnings season so far? I mean,
no.
As you mentioned, low quality beats. There are misses.
Yeah, but I think these are truly positioning issues because they were so beaten up. The market was so beaten up going into December or going into the new year that it's just a reflex trade.
Hold on, guys. We understand a British Prime Minister, Theresa May, is making a statement. Let's listen in.
The British people want us to get on with delivering Brexit and also address the other important issues they care about. But the deal which I have worked to agree with the European Union was rejected by MPs and by a large margin. I believe it is my duty to deliver on the British people's instruction to leave the European Union, and I intend to do so. So now MPs have made clear what they don't want, we must all work constructively together to set out what Parliament does want. That's why I'm inviting MPs from all parties to come together to find a way forward, one that both delivers on the referendum and can command the support of Parliament. This is now the time to put self-interest aside. I have just held constructive meetings with the leader of the Liberal Democrats and the Westminster leaders of the SNP and Plaid Cymru. From tomorrow, meetings will be taking place between senior government representatives, including myself, and groups of MPs who represent the widest possible range of views from across Parliament, including our confidence and supply partners, the Democratic Unionist Party. I am disappointed that the leader of the Labour Party has not so far chosen to take part, but our door remains open. It will not be an easy task, but MPs know they have a duty to act in the national interest, reach a consensus, and get this done. In a historic vote in 2016, the country decided to leave the EU. In 2017, 80% of people voted for parties that stood on manifestos promising to respect that result. Now, over 2.5 years later, it's time for us to come together, put the national interest first, and deliver on the referendum.
We've been listening to Prime Minister Theresa May making a statement in front of 10 Downing, this after winning a no-confidence vote earlier in the day by a very, very narrow margin, 325 to 302, indicating here that she will work with all parties here to come up with a plan to move forward on what the country decided 2 years ago, which was to leave the European Union. The longer this drags out, what does this mean for the markets? There are a lot more unknowns. This is a continued drag on not just the UK, but also on EU growth. And what does this do to central banks around the world?
So here's the problem. And yesterday we got a glimpse of it. When you start to hear about Draghi softening and turning more dovish immediately, we've heard our central bank, Powell, getting a little more dovish. So if that's the case, if there's going to be this global synchronized dovish feel, you would think the markets move higher. But I'm worried that it's going to be the opposite this time. The market's going to be skittish, worried about why everyone is so afraid.
It seems like both sides are kind of digging their heels in right now. I mean, the EU has to be strict about this. If they're not strict about it, then all the other countries are going to start walking all over them. So I think you're just going to see more volatility until there finally is a deal. And we'll see what happens.
In terms of central banks, though, could this put the Fed more definitively on the sidelines for 2019?
I hope not, but probably will. I mean, I happen to think that Mr. Powell's saying to your point, he read from basically a script a couple of weeks ago. He said what the market wanted to hear. But I still think in the back of his head, he's going to do what he thinks is right. Now, that might be bad for markets. I think it's good for the long run. So I don't necessarily think it's going to make central banks more dovish. But, you know, that's probably more my hope than my feel.
All right. Our next guest says the market lows are in. Let's bring in the man who moves the markets, J.P. Morgan's global head of derivatives and quantitative strategy, Marco Kalanovic. Marco, great to have you back. Good to see you. Happy New Year. So the firm's stand is 3,100 by year end.
It's actually 3,000.
3,000, excuse me, 3,000 by year end. What brings us there, and what do you think has changed? Because towards the end of last year in the fall, you were actually bullish going into year end, and it didn't pan out.
Did not work out, you know. So sort of what happened in the Q4 was a sort of a series of shocks that were delivered to market. First in October, we had the de-risking of systematic investor, then a hedge fund, equity long short hedge fund degrossed and reduced end of October. And things stabilized a little bit in November, and we had the G20 progress on G20 and some progress also with the Fed, which we thought should be enough actually to push the market higher. What did happen in December was really a retail mutual fund liquidation unprecedented since 2008, retail kind of pulled the plug in an environment where there was no liquidity, so very scary, very ugly, ugly price action in the sort of first 3 weeks of December. Really what saved the situation in December were pension funds buying in the last week, So if you look at December on its own, it was largely driven by the flows. It was a retail investor first yanking money out of the market, and then pension funds plowing in, which basically pushed us up very quickly, back 7-8%, So December was really about the flows, and flows and positioning and complete collapse in liquidity. And liquidity is still very thin, So we did bounce back now a little bit, but we do point that positioning is still very, very low, So if you look at the equity hedge funds, their beta is, less than 10 percentile. Historically, if we look at some of these volatility sensitive investors like vol targeters, they're actually at the absolute low, so positioning is very low. You did have, as I mentioned, some of the pension fund bid. You had some short covering now and even a little bit of a short covering from some of these trend investors, which kind of push us up on a very low volume where we are now at, call it 2600 something, which is a level, end of October level, and kind of early December level. So the way we look at this December was a really, as a liquidity disruption, as a market driven by flow, we do acknowledge weakening in some fundamental data and derating of earnings. But we also do think that price is incorporating that largely at this point. So you could have actually data that is maybe not stellar, but stocks that are actually drifting higher on account of some relevering and maybe some opportunistic buying.
So Marco, let's just take it back 1 year. Mm-hmm. At this time, yep. You know, the consensus was that we were going to have really good growth, synchronized global mm-hmm. growth in 2018. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that was going to get every strategist, move back up to their 3,200 or whatever the yeah. average was mm-hmm. a year ago. So now we've had this reset. And I say to myself, OK, mm-hmm. so now the consensus is global synchronized slowing. And I just mm-hmm. I'm hard pressed to think, what are the catalysts that get us back to the prior highs and above that?
So our base case is there is no recession, that we did have a slowdown, that we had a drastic delevering. And as a result, that basically central banks will turn more dovish, will put sort of hiking on pause. So we're starting from kind of very low position, call it clean slate. Earnings did grow last year quite substantially, 20%+, and we are down 6%. So some gap did open, right? Even if we look at the small caps, earnings grow 30%, stocks were down 20% or so. So you have like 50% a margin of error for this, call it slowdown. And yes, we do recognize slowdown. And actually, the one thing that I do a little bit worry is Europe. It seems to be slowing up actually more than perhaps we were expecting. For China, we do think that there's a round of stimulus coming into that economy. And at some point, it will start showing up on a positive side. And then again, we are taking a bit of a leap of faith that U.S. is not going to go to recession. We do have a slowdown, but we don't go from 3.5 to negative. We slow somewhere in the low twos, but which can still actually grow your earnings. We are adding job, hence. And basically, the answer to our question is there's this buffer, right, where earnings went and when the stock went. So we think there's some room for, now price target. I was never a huge fan of price target. I tend to think statistically, so I say there's a probability we go there and probability we go there. And I still do have at the back of my mind some probability that we don't go much lower, but
what is that probability in the back of your mind?
Recession kind of probability, different models, so we have in-house model that shows about 35%. There's an economic based model, there's a market based model, Fed model shows 25, it's kind of, I would say my feeling would be to call it 25%.
What are you expecting for earnings growth in this year?
So we clearly do want to see a little bit of how the earnings season pans out, but we think mid to high single digits, for this year.
And then some multiple expansion as well?
Well, at least we think some stabilization of multiple or not further contraction. Maybe depends a bit on the Fed and also on the path of economy.
The volatility that we saw in the last quarter of the year, will we see that again this year, or is that a thing of the past?
We will see more frequently these type of episodes, and I have been writing about that for the last 5 years, so kind of 2015 and February to last year and then October and December, so I think these type of liquidity seizures, we'll see them, but they typically happen from the higher point of leverage, you re-lever fairly quickly, liquidity kind of shoots up, so everybody feels good, and then you immediately get slammed, liquidity disappears, systematic sellers come out and sell, option hedging program sell, so you have these kind of little tail events, so I think we will see them, but we just saw three or four, like October, December, so I think we could be in for like a little bit of a re-levering, reloading phase, so that's why I think basically positioning is something that I think can drive market higher despite the consensus, which is very bad.
We're running out of time, Marco, but I mean, in the era of machine trading, mm-hmm. I don't want to blame the machines. I'm not trying to mm-hmm. fault anybody or anything for volatility, but in this day and age where you can get in and out of positions much faster than mm-hmm. in the past, these bouts of volatility may not be surprising. And in fact, them occurring more frequently seems like that would have to be the norm at this point. You go through cycles much faster, right?
You do. We used to have kind of one every 2-3 years. Now we have two or three every year. Unfortunately, that might be a norm given the sort of structure of liquidity, electronic liquidity that can quickly, pull liquidity back or provide liquidity. And some of these, programmatic flows, it could be option hedging programs. It could be quants. It could be, insurance industry. But a lot of things do go on autopilot.
Marco, thank you. Always good to see you.
Thank you.
Marco Kolanovic.
Well, to get to 3,000, and Marco does a great job, and he doesn't like price targets, so I'm going to give him that. But if you give S&P earnings about $160, which, by the way, I think is probably high this year given what we're seeing, that's a 19 multiple to get to 3,000. I don't know how you get to a 19 forward multiple in the environment that we find ourselves in. So, look, can we get to 3,000? When you're betting against this market, you tend to be wrong, but I have a hard time mathematically getting there.
So we've got a year-end target of 2,850. And we get to that by looking at 2020 earnings being right around $180 and the multiple expanding a little bit out to about 15.8. So we're a little shy of the 3,000 mark.
So you know what I'm left off with? You have Europe, you have Japan, and you have China teetering on what could be a recession. You have Powell, even if he stops, takes the Powell pause, QT, still running off. So you have a tightening cycle, global slowdown, recessions rampant all around the world, lower markets.
Coming up, CSX down after hours, but the transports are on track for the best January in 6 years. One top technician says they've run too far too fast. He'll explain. Plus, it's ramping up to be a huge year for IPOs, but it's just a waiting game as a government shutdown continues. Early investor Rick Heitzman tells us what it could mean for the tech unicorns. And later, one company just spent $22 billion to take on Square. But can it compete with the payment giant? We've got all the details. We're live from Times Square in New York City. Much more fast right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of CSX moving lower after hours. The railroad company reporting better than expected quarterly earnings and revenue and authorizing a $5 billion share buyback. And with the help of a few strong airlines reports, the Dow Transports rallying 5% this month, tracking for its best January in 6 years. With stocks like United, Avis, FedEx hauling higher. So will transports keep on trucking? Although CSX is a little bit of a wrinkle given its move in the after hour session.
Huge wrinkle. I mean, listen, to talk about the transports, it's a pretty kind of wide swath. If you think about it, we got bad news out of the cruise lines, out of some of the airlines initially, obviously FedEx in late December. And when you think about CSX, this is a better read on what's moving around our country, how the U.S. economy is doing. I don't think that the guidance that they gave was pretty disappointing.
Although there's really some that say that railroads aren't indicative of the economy anymore. But I think it is, to your point, a better gauge on what we think the economy is supposed to do. And if these guys are really ripping higher, then that's a great sign for the economy.
So we downgraded railroads on October 30th. This is a very capital intensive industry. And what we see them doing is they are reducing CapEx and they're taking on a lot of debt to buy back shares, which is exactly what CSX is doing. And what that does is it just puts them in a tough spot in the event that the economy does take a downturn.
Mm-hmm. What's a better read of the economy in your view? Trains or planes?
Wow.
Well, trains, I asked that because
I'll give you an answer. I'll play the game with
UAL
you.
UAL did well.
If our economy is 73% driven by the consumer, I think that's about right, then I would say planes is a better read-through for the economy. I think I'm sort of taking Steve's point on this one. So I'd say planes. In terms of CSX, though, I mean, the stock's been in a pretty significant downtrend for the last 9 months. The bounce you've seen is a bounce we've seen before at 15 times forward earnings. I don't think it's all that cheap. I think it rolls over here.
Our next guest says there is trouble brewing in the transports, but one name is still looking like a buy. J.C. O'Hara of MKM Partners is over at the Plasma to break it down. Hey, J.C.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
Good. What are you looking at?
So transports, you know, what does that mean for the overall market? Now, you like to see transports move higher in a bull market, and you actually like to see the relative line of transports to the Dow Jones Industrial confirm that bullish price action. Unfortunately, we have not seen that. If you go back to the beginning of 2018, January, we had the nice rally in the market. However, if you look at the relative line, we actually made a lower high. So that itself is a bearish divergence with price. If we come back here to the August-September highs, what happened? The relative line, again, failed to make a new high. So consequently, we rolled over. Now, what was interesting, in November, we actually had a little counter trend move in the market. We actually saw some signs of improvement with the relative line. However, this January rally is showing zero signs of relative improvement. It actually looks like we're pretty darn close to making a 52-week relative low in the entire transport sector. So trust, that is a giant concern. Now, if we look at the next chart, UPS, you know, this was one of those former bellwethers. You want to see UPS doing well. And you know what? Let's go back to January. We look at January, UPS was making a high on an absolute basis, and that overall was positive. But if you look at the relative performance versus the S&P, failed to make a new high. So again, you didn't see that bullish confirmation. When the entire market rolled over and started picking up over the month, March, April, May, FedEx on an absolute basis started to try to participate, but on a relative basis, couldn't get out of the mud. We saw it roll over before the overall market, so that kind of gave you a gauge. When the market's down 20% from its highs, we want to be looking at stocks that are rebounding the strongest off the lows. The average stock since the December 24th low is up nearly 13%. UPS up 8%. So yes, absolute, it's doing okay, but that's 400, 500 basis points of underperformance. So UPS is another stock that we want to stay away from. And Melissa, to answer your question, what is better, rails or planes or trains or planes? I brought one bullish chart here, and that is of Spirit Airlines. I love this longer term base that it's tracing out here. We can make the case that this chart is showing you a double bottom here. Now, how many stocks actually gapped up 15% during that entire October through December decline? Well, this is one of them right here. Now, there's a little resistance here at 65. If we get above 65, I think this has another $10 upside. So like this chart, keep an eye on it. 65 is a key level.
JC, did you say the average stock is up 13% from the December lows?
From the December 24th lows, the average stock is up 13%. Yes.
That's amazing that the average stock has made that move. JC, thanks. JC O'Hara of MKM Partners. Anybody like Save?
Steve Gross, a Steve Grosso name. Go to the Hulk over there. I mean,
that is
Hulk.
A name that
the Hulk.
I thought you said the Hulk. No,
well, that too.
New to me.
That is a name that outperforms, and it's kind of a sneaky airlines where the chart, everyone kind of forgets about this one. They trade the marquee players. This is one that's been flying under radar, has really no effect with the government shutdown for this one. People sort of glide into this one. If you want profitability, where if you think the airline's going to do well, this has a higher beta, and you get a little more leverage with this one versus the other names.
Like any of the transport names.
I'm terrified of the airlines in general. I mean, it's just a really
personally,
tough business.
Personally, getting on one? Or?
No, it actually owning them. So tough business to be in. You know, fuel costs have come down. And you would think that profits could increase, but that's not the way it works. Instead, they have to immediately pass all those savings on to the customer because it's such a highly competitive business. So, no, not a big fan of the transportation
stocks. I think the lack of balance in FedEx and UPS is really troubling. And I think that we're talking about what does the bank rally off of the December lows mean for the broader markets. And I think if you look at some of these names in the transports and you look at the inability for a FedEx and a UPS to rally, I think that weakness is much more significant than the bounce that we've seen in the banks if you're trying to extrapolate things to the broader market.
I still cannot wrap my head around the average stock moving 13% from the December lows.
You asked that.
Because average, she said. You know.
Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Doesn't that tell you something?
But doesn't that tell you something? That it was just so overdone.
Right.
People were so shocked with it that there's indiscriminate buying of all sectors, all space, all names.
Yeah.
Well, to Dan's point, Federal Express, for example, bottomed at 150. It's 171 now, which is percentage-wise a decent bounce. But FedEx topped out at 275 beginning of last year. This will be the fourth time you've had a huge move. The downside, bounce, not a new high. Downside, bounce, not a new high. So the trend is clearly still lower. You have to wonder when FedEx starts to roll over again.
All right. For more on the transports, head on over to tradingnation.cnbc.com. I'm Melissa Lee. You're watching Fast Money on CNBC, first in business worldwide. In the meantime, here's what else is coming up on Fast.
I imagined that there was such a thing as a unicorn.
Well, Michael, there might just be. We'll tell you which of the big IPOs this year are ready to take flight. Plus, the payment stocks are heating up. And there's one player in the space that just made a $20 billion bet it's going to come out on top. We will explain.
We have some very sad news to share with you tonight. John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, has passed away at the age of 89. He was a frequent guest on CNBC. Tyler Matheson has a look back at Bogle's incredible career that helped shape the investment industry.
Indexing always works best, up, down, or sideways.
In 1975, Jack Bogle started the Vanguard Group, and with it, a new way of investing.
Jack was the creator, effectively, of the index funds.
Index funds, mutual funds whose portfolios match a market barometer like the S&P 500, are commonplace today. But they were unheard of in the 1970s, much less the early 1950s, when Bogle wrote his senior thesis about the concept at Princeton.
I said mutual funds should be operated in the most honest, efficient, and economical way possible. I had a sentence in my thesis that said mutual funds can make no claim to superiority over the market averages.
Bogle's thesis research laid the groundwork for what would become one of the most powerful investing movements of the late 20th century. He concluded that active trading mutual fund managers failed as a group to outperform the relevant indexes, especially when you subtract fees and expenses.
Anybody can do it for a year, and a few can do it for 5 years, and a few can do it for 10 years. But over an investment lifetime, there's about a 3% chance that a money manager can beat the market.
After Princeton, Bogle went to work for Wellington Management for over 2 decades, eventually becoming CEO. He was later terminated for what he called an unwise merger. So he started over, putting the indexing concepts from his thesis into practice at Vanguard.
Investors suddenly found the playing field more level. So to a certain extent, in fact, to a great extent, I would say, he democratized investing for individuals, which was a huge contribution in the mutual fund space.
That initial fund, called the First Index Investment Trust and later renamed the Vanguard 500 Index, tracked the S&P 500. Skeptics ridiculed it as Bogle's folly. But by 1990, index investing had taken root. The reason? Bogle turned out to be right. In the 15 years ending in January 2017, 9 out of 10 actively managed large-cap mutual funds underperformed Vanguard's 500 index. Today, Vanguard has more than $5 trillion under management.
Jack Bogle is pretty much like a T-Rex in terms of what Vanguard is versus, you know, a little tiny lizard over here. You don't see too many folks anywhere in the world that manage that much money.
After retiring from Vanguard in 1999, Bogle started a research center on the Vanguard campus. There, he continued advocating for indexing and buy and hold long-term investing. He called trading stocks a loser's game.
It comes right out of Shakespeare. These moves in the market are like a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. I think it's speculators speculating on what other speculators are speculating on.
And speaking of speculation, few would have bet on Vanguard back in 1975. Even fewer still would have thought Bogle would still be jousting with critics deep into the second decade of the 21st century. He had his first heart attack at age 31. Doctors said he wouldn't make it to 40, much less live to 89. He had 5 more heart attacks before undergoing a heart transplant at the age of 65.
Well, I may be. I don't want to get carried away here. The luckiest guy in the world.
Jack Bogle dead at the age of 89. Let's bring in Bob Pisani from the New York Stock Exchange. And really, Jack Bogle made it possible for Americans across the country to participate in the financial markets.
He did, and he had a huge impact on investing and on me personally, Melissa. I remember in 1993, after 3 years at CNBC, I was astonished at how few active managers were able to outperform their bogey. And one of Bogle's central insights is, in fact, very few do, and why not just go along with big parts of the market? He was one of the first people to create an S&P 500 fund that essentially mimicked the S&P 500, and you could buy into it, into his fund. I remember in 1993, after looking at the underperformance of all these fund managers, finally kind of coming over to Bogle's attitude about the whole thing. Of course, it wasn't just that you could get into them and buy into the S&P 500. It was cheaper. Remember, you were paying 2%, 2.5% per year for active management at the time. Most of them were not outperforming. Suddenly, you could buy in for a fraction of that into the S&P 500. It was a simple insight, yet really revolutionary.
And think about how we've built from that concept of the index fund, correct, Bob? I mean, right now we have an industry filled with ETFs, which would not have been made possible without the thinking that you could actually create a fund that is simply an index of the S&P 500.
And the great irony here about ETFs is Jack Bogle was not always a big fan of ETFs. This is ETFs independent of mutual funds. He felt in the earlier days that ETFs would encourage too much active trading because you could trade them intraday, unlike a mutual fund. And he really resisted this for a while, the concept. Fortunately, Vanguard, which had since moved on, he wasn't running Vanguard at the time, went very big into ETFs. It turned out to be a fantastic move. Vanguard itself quickly surpassed Fidelity, its big rival, because Fidelity was slower getting into the ETF business, and as a result of Vanguard's decision to sort of go against Jack's wishes, Vanguard is now a giant. It's number two in the ETF business after BlackRock. So the company itself has made some amazing moves even after Jack Bogle left managing the day-to-day affairs.
And even after Jack left Vanguard on a day-to-day basis, Bob, what was so amazing about him is that he would always come onto CNBC and he would basically be the face, the champion of the individual investor, really advocating that people should be involved in this market, be buy and hold investors, and he wouldn't be shy about giving his opinions on that.
Yeah, he was somewhat astonished by, I remember having a conversation with him one day about our fixation on, for example, what the sectors were doing on a day-to-day basis. He kind of thought a lot of this was noise because he was such a long-term investor. And when I said, you know, Jack, there are people who want to try to play the markets on a shorter-term basis. We don't always want to hold for 25 years. Some people want to move. He said, oh, I understand that, Bob. But you know, Bob, how difficult and impossible, he used to say, it is to actually time market activities. He felt a lot of these attempts just weren't going to be successful for most people. And stay long, have a plan, and don't deviate from the plan was his primary message to all of us.
Yes. Bob, thank you. Thank you for sharing your remembrances of Jack Bogle, Vanguard founder, dead at the age of 89. And, of course, he's had profound impacts on all of us, either individually or just on our industry, as we were talking about with Bob.
I think what really hits home is when Jack talks about the individual hedge fund manager or fund manager who can't beat the market consistently. And when you look at it to a grassroots event, we have four traders on the desk tonight. Sometimes we're going to be wrong. Sometimes we're going to be right. And that's why you have to get this difference of opinion. But one person to beat the market is impossible to do it with any longevity. That's why you have to be in the indexes.
Okay. Again, Vanguard founder Jack Bogle dead at the age of 89. Welcome back to Fast Money, a $22 billion deal taking aim at some of the biggest payment players like PayPal and Square. For more on what this could mean for the space, Deirdre Bosa is live in San Francisco with more. Deirdre.
Melissa, one analyst I talked to called the deal a super defensive move in response to the success of Square. Fiserv sells services and systems to banks and financial institutions. First Data operates more in the physical payment space, point of sale devices and products. So the idea is that together they'll be able to serve both merchants and card issuing interests. But guys, the Squares and PayPals of the world are already doing both, and they're adding on more and more financial services. They process payments, have debit cards, their own successful peer-to-peer payments apps, and they lend to small businesses. Square Capital is moving into consumer lending, and the company has twice applied for a banking license. They've essentially become a one-stop shop that are encroaching on traditional banking territory, a threat that Fiserv CEO acknowledged this morning in a call to analysts.
A lot of banks, especially in the community spaces, are worried about companies like Square. And what do you do where Square has a rapidly growing point-of-sale lending business, and that's going to take money out of the revenue line of the banks?
Well, Fiserv and First Data say that they'll be investing $500 million over the next 5 years on new tech in areas like merchant solutions and digital services. They also say they want to better leverage First Data's Clover point-of-sale system for small businesses. In other words, they want to catch up to what Square has already been building. Now, Yabuki also called Clover a great opportunity for community banks to fight back. Melissa.
All right, Deirdre, thank you. Deirdre Bosa in San Francisco. What's interesting is that Square apparently recently has been targeting mid-sized businesses, which is really Clover and Clover Go's sweet spot. So the bulk of their volume growth recently has been in this mid-sized category. Why are you looking at me
because the banks,
like, so
because,
what?
Because, no, it's actually a really important point. The banks were so focused. They weren't focused on Square because Square was really focused on small businesses, right? Mm-hmm. So now that they're moving upstream, they've had this relative bit of success, they're on everybody's radar. And I suspect Square is not going to be an independent company for too much longer.
Oh, so they're going to be bought, you think, just because this is happening? Yeah. Clover and Clover Go, the suite of services, point of sale services, deeper pockets, right? I mean, presumably.
Fiserv FDC.
Well, I mean, I look at Fiserv, for example, and, you know, on valuation, say it's still an expensive stock. The stock has been deteriorating now for the last few months. I mean, they report earnings, I think, in about 2 or 3 weeks. I would stay away from this. In terms of Square, you wonder, I mean, I'll say this, I don't know if it makes any sense, and Dan will laugh at me, but I've thought this for a while, and I mean, it seems logical. Like, Apple and Square together makes perfect sense to me.
Google, services business, this is where this is. I've been long this name on and off. I'm consistently long from $12, right? So when I bought it, I didn't buy it for a payments processor. I bought it for a services company. That was what was really attractive, because you get a services company, you could slap any multiple you want to put on it. You get payment processes, you are limited to what you're going to have the stock trade at. But I do believe it's a takeout. It's getting crushed on that value versus growth into year end.
Are you long?
I'm still long.
Okay, Mark.
So in this space, I actually like Visa. I'd rather own the credit card processor. Visa is really kind of an all-weather stock. I mean, it's got good global diversification and it's got a strong debit card presence. So if you look back to the last recession, credit was down double digits. Debit was actually positive. So I think Visa would be a good play at this stage of the cycle.
All right. Coming up, a number of huge tech IPOs waiting in the wings, but the government shutdown could be throwing a wrench in the plans of what Wall Street was expecting to be a major year for public debuts. We'll explain. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Fast. There is a robust IPO pipeline for 2019. 160 companies have filed to go public with the SEC, including big names like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, Palantir, WeWork, and Pinterest. Uber alone may have a valuation of $72 billion, and Pinterest is interviewing bankers in preparation for an IPO, according to Recode. But the government shutdown could be throwing a wrench in the plans. Rick Heitzman is the founder of First Mark Capital. He's an early investor in both Airbnb and Pinterest. Rick, it's always good to see you.
Good to see you again.
So SEC only has essential employees. They're not dealing with IPOs. What's happening at this point?
At this point, nothing. Yeah. That's the scary part, that nothing is happening. But, you know, you'd think that we're 2 weeks into the year. It's not even Martin Luther King Day yet. And, you know, the tweets are going that there's, you know, there might not be any public financings in 2019. It's way premature. Mm-hmm. So you think about all the things that have to happen. The SEC still has 28 days to reply to a filing. Assuming that the SEC reopens, government shutdown reopens, it won't even impact the IPO windows by a quarter.
So this is not something that's really a concern of yours whatsoever. Yeah. When it comes to your portfolio companies. At what point does it become a concern? Is it a month into the shutdown? Is it 2 months?
I think that you're going to see just an accordion back based on how long the shutdown is. If it's a month back, it'll be a little bit less than a month. The issue is, and I think it's going to be an issue for all IPOs this year, I think the mega deals, the ones you talked about, the Ubers, the Lyfts, the Palantirs, are going to get done regardless of market conditions and regardless of what happens in the government, because they're big known companies that people want to buy. People might need to buy if they think they're the future of transportation. If you're the next tier of companies or two-tier companies down, you're not in every everyday name, you won't be able to get mind share if there's a backup of IPOs, then therefore you might have to push it out to create your own window in a crowded market.
Are there any companies like that in your portfolio? We're trying to work through a plan B, so to speak, for 2019?
Not yet. I think that we set it up that we're going to be able to finance these companies almost regardless of economic condition. You know, the fear of a potential recession has people thinking about establishing a fortress balance sheet. A lot of companies establish what they call a fortress balance sheet in 2018, where they can control their own destiny aside from financing risk. And therefore, people aren't worried about anything like this for the next couple weeks.
Hey, so, Rick, that's a really good point. I mean, think about the tens of billions of dollars that's been raised in equity and in debt for some of these mega names, Airbnb, Uber, that sort of thing. Does it give you guys like this runway to actually delay them if you wanted to, if the conditions weren't correct because of volatility? Let's say the SEC gets back in order.
I think that most people have already taken that delay. They've already said, I'm going to do my mega private financing round. I'll take care of early liquidity. I'll take care of providing plan B, plan C. I think now a lot of these companies are saying it's time to kind of play in the big leagues. We'll wait for the SEC to reopen, which should be shortly.
Okay. Rick, great to see you. Thank you
always
so much. Rick Heitzman of First Mark Capital. In case you're just tuning in earlier, we reported the news that Jack Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, the creator of the index fund, has passed away at the age of 89. Just a couple months ago, I had the opportunity to speak to Jack Bogle. Take a listen. Do you think that the market structure as it is right now could contribute to this sort of liquidity crunch the next time we have a volatility spike?
Well, to be honest, there are areas of the exchange-traded fund market in particular that could be very much subject to the same kind of pressures, liquidity pressures that you're talking about. When you get into the main part of the index fund market, the S&P 500, the total U.S. stock market, it's not really conceivable because they are the market. And if there's a panic there, there will be a panic everywhere by definition.
Always a straight speaking guy, that Jack Bogle. Let's bring in Becky Quick, who just spoke to Warren Buffett about Jack moments ago. Becky.
Hi, Melissa. You know, Warren Buffett really admired Jack Bogle, and when he heard the news about Jack Bogle's passing, he had a lot to say about it. He's known Jack for many years. He said that Jack Bogle has done more for America's investors as a whole than any individual that he's known. Buffett said that Bogle not only saved investors a lot in the fees that he made them more long-term oriented instead, he also said he thinks that if you would find the turnover numbers in the S&P 500 index funds versus the ETF are very different. And he thinks that Bogle really did a lot to reset the investors' minds. And just pointed out again that he brought down fees dramatically for those who followed his words. He made a couple of comments about Jack. He said that a lot of Wall Street is really devoted to charging a lot for nothing, but Bogle charged nothing to accomplish a huge amount. He said that Bogle covered in a 30-year period a lot of people and converted a lot of people in a 30-year period to the right religion of investing, and he said it's a good religion. It really pays off. But again, he said that there's no one he can think of in the world of investing who has done more for America's investors than Jack Bogle, and that's because of the fees that he brought down. He pointed out that if you're looking at index funds out there, maybe it's about $3 trillion right now, but he said even if you're talking about $1 trillion, if you're talking about management fees of 1% over the course of a year, that would cost investors about $10 billion, and Jack Bogle successfully brought that number down to just about zero. So just really pointing out all the good that Jack Bogle did for Main Street investors.
Yeah, he really brought investing to the American public at large, Becky, and you and I know very well that people who watch are programming all day long. They may be invested in individual stocks, but for the most part, most people who are watching are invested in mutual funds or ETFs, and all of that would not be possible without Jack Bogle and what he wrote about in his Princeton thesis, which is just amazing to think that so long ago, as a college student, he thought of the idea of the index fund.
That's right. Really converted things and managed to convert a huge portion of America over the course of probably just 3 decades or a little.
All right, Becky, thank you so much for tuning in. Our own Becky Quick, who spoke to Warren Buffett moments ago. I just want to read an excerpt from the statement that was released by Vanguard. This is from the Vanguard CEO, Tim Buckley. Jack Bogle made an impact on not only the entire investment industry, but more importantly, on the lives of countless individuals saving for their futures or their children's futures. He was a tremendously intelligent, driven, and talented visionary whose ideas completely changed the way we invest. We are honored to continue his legacy of giving every investor a fair shake. And that's really what it has been about. I mean, for so long, Wall Street has been maligned as being an insider's club. And all of a sudden, with the index fund, that club opened up to a whole audience of investors who never had the opportunity, really, to invest in the stock market before.
Think about the words from Warren Buffett, who's done more for the American investor than anybody he can think of. I mean, that's pretty high praise coming from somebody who could probably claim that title himself. So it's pretty incredible. And to your point, he leveled the playing field for all of the citizens of this country. It's a pretty remarkable life.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll have more on Jack throughout the hour here as we close up. But again, Jack Bogle, the founder of the Vanguard Group, dead at 89. Welcome back to Fast Money. Take a look at shares of Netflix, up 50% since those December lows as it gears up for earnings after the bell tomorrow. Dan Nathan, what is the options market expecting?
So an 8.5% move in either direction, Mel. That's rich to its 7.5% move over the last four quarters. Interestingly enough, that implied move has come down with the stock's huge rip this week. The stock's up 32% on the year. It's up 53% from its Christmas massacre lows here. Obviously, sentiment's running really, really hot into that print last night, especially with that subscriber price increase the other day. You know, if you watch OA last Friday, I was fading it 15, 20 bucks lower. I'm still fading it here.
All right. For more options action, check out the full show Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Next up, final trades. Time for the final trade. Steve Grasso.
GE up 18% year-to-date. Sneaky. It's going to continue to perform in a sneaky fashion. GE.
Mark Tepper.
Long term, I love Netflix, but as a trade, I'm selling it ahead of earnings. I'm concerned about subscriber growth.
Dan.
So XLF, it overshot to the downside last month. It's overshot to the upside now. I'm a seller here.
Gee.
Can't wait for OA tomorrow.
Oh, I mean, really?
Huge. That's on Fridays, though, guy.
Today is not Thursday?
No.
It's our anniversary, by the way.
No, what?
That's a tease. That's a tease.
On Friday?
Yes.
10-year anniversary?
Yes.
Can I come to the show just,
sure.
like, just to
You're
say
here
hi?
Open invitation.
American Barrick, I think gold sneaky as well, ABX.
All right, that does it for us. Thanks for watching. See you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast. Meantime, don't go anywhere. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.